I'm Vermont Edition co-host Bob Kinzel. Just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. I don't mean to put a damper on the joy of the season with today's topic, but you should be aware that wintertime carries risk for home and barn fires. There's a lot of cooking going on now, and stoves can be a common place for fires to start. Plus heating, whether it's leaving something on a heating unit, having a faulty space heater, not clearing out your chimney, heating poses a risk. Even your Christmas tree, if not properly attended to, carries danger. So today we're going to go over some of the risks in hopes of mitigating them. And we're going to hear about the challenges of fighting fires at this time of year. I'm joined now by two very experienced firefighters. Eric Haversang is fire chief at St. Michael's College Fire and Rescue. Eric, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks for having us.
And Prescott Natto is senior firefighter on the Williston Fire Department. Prescott, nice to have you here as well.
Thanks.
So let's talk a little bit about some of these causes of fires, and we can tick through a bunch of them. And just to remind people, because sometimes you sort of forget either what's in your house or what's a potential fire risk. So let's talk about space heaters and radiators. So Prescott, what's the risk, and what should we be aware of with space heaters and radiators?
The biggest thing with space heaters and radiators is what you put close to them. And our biggest concern there is anything flammable. A lot of times folks in the hustle and bustle of this holiday season aren't necessarily thinking about the fact that those are on to provide heat, but they also, if you put anything from, you know, towels, anything other flammable items near them, they could catch
winter mittens that have been out in the snow,
absolutely.
For example. Not
almost
a good idea?
No, not necessarily at all. You want about a 3-foot radius around any of those heating objects.
And space heaters in particular, I always think of as like setting off alarm bells for a potential fire. What's particularly bad about space heaters?
Space heaters can malfunction both from an electrical standpoint as well as what we just spoke about, which is the heating element in them and the fact that they're not as protected as, for example, a standard home heating system.
Yeah, that heating element is right out there. I mean, you can burn yourself as well as put something on it and potentially cause a fire.
Absolutely. Pets, children, you know, things to be very concerned about. That 3-foot radius is great for flammable objects, but you can't necessarily rely on telling your child once and having them, you know, learn. You don't want them to have to learn the hard way on that situation.
Eric, what about stoves and wood stoves and fireplaces? Particular risks, things we should be aware of with those?
Yeah, so I think the big one is ensuring that you get your wood stove or your fireplace serviced annually. So you want to make sure that you have a licensed professional come in, take care of all the creosote buildup that may have happened the year before, and then burn, you know, dry, clean wood. Don't burn, you know, the table and, you know, random stuff that you may find around the house.
All right, I'm going to play a character here because I promise I wouldn't do this in real life. But come on, doesn't actually running my wood stove clear out the chimney and I don't need to worry about it because all that fire is going up, all the creosote's going out, and I'm fine. I don't need to inspect it every year.
Well, as long as you're burning at the right temperatures, you limit the risk of creosote buildup. If it's too hot or too cool, you will see an opportunity or a chance for the creosote to build up, which down the road could create a problem.
And do you see fires in chimneys?
We do. I think for us in Colchester, it's a little bit on the rare side, probably 2 or 3, you know, a season. But I think there's definitely a kind of ebbs and flows. So sometimes when it's real cold, you might see an increase because people are using their chimneys a lot. And then when it's, you know, a warmer winter, we don't typically see them as often.
Any difference between a wood stove and a fireplace in terms of maintenance or risk that we should be aware of?
No, it's all in terms of the preventative maintenance, really the same.
For a fireplace, do you have to worry about sparks flying out, you know, if you have an open hearth?
You have to worry about ensuring that the damper and the flue are open. So if you don't open those, you know, the first time you go to light a fire, it's going to kind of backfill the house with smoke, and then that's a lot of times when we get called because, oh, my house is filling up with smoke. You know, the residents are kind of panicked, and probably 8 times out of 10, it's just we have to open it up and get it operating properly.
Prescott, what about cooking stoves?
Cooking is honestly it's the number one cause of fires in the nation, and actually that presents a hazard, especially during this holiday time frame, because folks are doing a lot of cooking, family, friends coming over to enjoy that. The problem is what folks fail to do is stay with the item that they're cooking, whether it be in the oven or on the stovetop. There's a lot of stuff going on, so they tend to wander out into the living room or catch the football game, whatever it might be that is somewhat distracting. And it is amazing how fast something can occur. Like I was mentioning, whether it be a pet or a child, having some type of interference on what's on the stovetop, or just the fact that you may forget about that object completely, which can cause a fire incredibly fast. And being the number one cause of fires, it happens more frequently than I think we'd all like to admit.
Yeah, that's kind of surprising that it's the number one cause of fires. Is it really just people forgetting?
I think it's a combination of both forgetfulness and the fact that, when you're dealing with, it doesn't necessarily have to be a gas stove. I think human error, human nature is in this day and age to be a little bit distracted or a lot of bit distracted, which can yield some unfortunate results when it comes to flammable objects too near that stovetop, for example.
But, you know the expression, a watched pot never boils. And I know among your tips is like, don't even go downstairs and do the laundry and, check the laundry while something is cooking. That just seems so unrealistic.
I will say it is. I'll be the first one to tell you that I would be hypocritical if I told you I have not wandered down, But I think the gist of what we're trying to get across from a safety standpoint is, especially when you start cooking these larger meals and you have a lot of different things going on, family, friends, pets, kids in the kitchen area, or even wandering through, that's where the hazard kind of is, and things to be aware of.
Or like in my house where we drop all of our mail right next to the stove, and all it would take is, one gust of wind or, one errant elbow, and suddenly that piece of mail is right in the gas stove.
And nobody thinks it's going to happen to them. I'll speak for myself in saying that I'm a firefighter, for Pete's sake. I don't think anything like that's going to happen, but I still have to have safety on my mind. So if something like that does occur, I am prepared.
Eric, I know the other question about stoves is that for some people, heating is really difficult at this time of year in terms of cost. I mean, if you're trying to figure out how to keep your home heated and you've run out of propane or heating oil, you might turn to the stove, and that can be a fire risk. I know that one of the things that you want to talk about is making sure that you're using things appropriately for the use they're designed for. So what happens with stoves?
So what can happen is if you use the stove, for something other than cooking. So let's say you turn the burners on and you're trying to heat, the kitchen or the room, what Prescott was talking about, you might drop something, you put something down, the cat might knock something over, something like that. So that's just an increased opportunity for something to go wrong. If you crack the stove, the oven open and you're heating, somebody might walk into it, something might fall into it. After a while, these things are going to get really hot. They're not designed to be running 12, 24 hours at a time. And that's, that's kind of the obstacle that you'll be up against is now you're using this piece of equipment the way it's not designed. It's going to get overheated. It's going to be overworked. And now you're kind of opening yourself up for the opportunity for something wrong or bad to happen.
Rick is calling in from Wyndham. Hi, Rick. What are your thoughts?
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
My question is, I have a wood stove. I only burn 2 cords of wood a year. Do I really need to clean it out every year?
All right, so we don't have the chimney experts here, but we have firefighters. So what about it? From your perspective as fire risk mitigators, for somebody who's not using it a ton, does he need to actually get it inspected every year?
I think we want to be very considerate of the fact that burning 2 cords of wood versus 10 cords of wood or something in that nature is going to present a difference in the buildup that you might have of that really dangerous creosote. And the key with that is it is not 1 or 2 or 3 fires necessarily that buildup's going to occur. It's a season or 2's worth of buildup. And so it does depend on the amount of use your stove wood stove or chimney receives. With burning, for example, the 2 cords of wood, I can't necessarily sit here and say, yes, every single year you must do it. But the absolute recommendation is that, you know, maybe for the two-cord burn every other year, or especially if that does spike and you do start to – it's a cold year and you do start to burn more wood than you have in past years.
Rick, when is the last time you had your chimney cleaned?
I do it every 2 years.
Ah, so you're in good shape. Rick, I appreciate the call. Thank you for that. We also got an email from Aaron, who works for Catamount Chimney Service, and he says, although the colder temps have already set in and folks are using their wood stoves to keep warm, it isn't too late to have your chimneys swept and inspected. Chimney fires have the potential to spread beyond the chimney, causing a home to catch fire, and removing creosote buildup in the chimney goes a long way towards reducing the possibility of a chimney fire. So Aaron, in the business, but certainly would know about creosote buildup. Let's go to Joe, who's on the line with us from Warren. Hey, Joe.
Hey there. I'm just calling to get recommendations on smoke detectors, because they seem so unreliable. They suck down batteries fast. I know a lot of people who've had them malfunction, both the plug-in kind and the battery operated. So a lot of folks I know, you know, end up not having them after a while because, you know, they just aren't so reliable. Any recommendations about how to keep that going, the smoke detectors running in the house?
Thanks for the call, Joe. Eric, what do you think?
So I think, I guess it depends on the home that you have and how your system is set up. If there are standalone smoke detectors, you can go to the local store. You want to make sure that you buy a photoelectric detector, and ideally one that is reading for smoke and carbon monoxide. If they're not hardwired in terms of, you know, the electrical power in your home, battery backup or battery powered is ideal. And then you want to change those batteries twice a year. So typically we tell people at daylight savings time, you're going to replace the batteries. A lot of the new detectors now, some manufacturers out there, they make a 10-year lifespan on the detector. And then after 10 years, it makes a certain cadence in terms of the chirps, and you know that it's time to replace it. So the best bet would be to replace the batteries twice a year. And if that doesn't seem to work, then I would maybe talk to like a local alarm company or something along those lines to see what they can do to help you.
Do you have preferences in terms of how well they work between a hardwired system and just a battery-operated standalone system?
So they all functionally operate the same. They'll all detect smoke or carbon monoxide. Hardwired is just the electrical is – you know, it runs off the electricity in the home. If it's just a battery smoke detector, it's run from that battery. So you really have to be diligent about replacing them, the batteries, twice a year. I think what a lot of people don't realize is that if you don't have a home security system and your fire alarms do activate in your home, somebody still has to call 911 or call the local dispatch center, because the fire department's not going to get notified on that. And if they do go off, I mean, that's what we're here for. We're happy to go check, see what's going on. It could be something as small as, you know, the battery needs to be changed, or it could be something as serious as there's carbon monoxide in the home. So it's always better to call and have us come out and double check and see what's going on instead of just ignoring it, or, you know, just taking the batteries out and taking the detector down.
How many smoke detectors do you need in your house, and where should you put them?
So there's not an exact quantity, but they need to be in your bedroom. And then outside in a hallway outside of the bedroom. That's where they're by the state. And if you go on to the state fire safety website, they actually have a really good matrix of smoke alarms, where they need to be placed, and carbon monoxide detectors as well, where they need to be placed.
Before we leave the subject, I have a very serious question to ask you about smoke detectors, which is, I'm hoping you can answer why the batteries always die in the middle of the night. It never happens in the day. It's always in the middle of the night. You're dead asleep and suddenly that chirping.
I'd love to know the answer to that question too. I have no idea. Couldn't tell you. But
Great.
That's, you know, we typically, like, 2 a.m., 3 a.m., we get called for, you know, my alarm's chirping. So we go and basically we'll change the batteries, or, you know, if the detector is expired, it's past its useful life, we take it down and instruct the homeowner how to get a new one.
Prescott, do you know the answer? I mean, is why it's always 2 a.m., 3 a.m.?
Oh, I believe it's a conspiracy.
Yeah, I do too. I'm convinced, because I have never had a battery go off in the day when it's easy to replace it. It's always like power outage, middle of the night, kids are screaming, dogs are barking.
Same reason why my wife is the one who is always changing the batteries, because I'm at work. It just happens to be that every single time I'm on my 24-hour shift, that's when the batteries decide to die.
Coincidence? I think not. Let's go to Joseph calling in from St. Albans. Hi, Joseph.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say there's a lot of old homes out in Vermont. I had a cousin one year who had his pipes get frozen up and tried to unthaw them with a blowtorch, thinking that would be a good idea. And his whole house burned down. So I just wanted to hear the take on frozen pipes and the best way to deal with that.
Yeah, Joseph, I'm so sorry to hear about that experience. That's a terrible thing to have happen, but I'm glad you brought up frozen pipes and how to thaw them out. Eric and Prescott, you're making signals at each other. Does one of you want to take this?
Yeah, I can take it. So I know that we've, our department, we've responded to a few fires where somebody was trying to heat the pipes or unfreeze them. And I think the best recommendation is that companies do make, heat wrap for the pipes that are specifically designed to do that. So I think that instead of, trying to thaw them out and kind of having the fire happen, it would be better to purchase the heat wrap it around the water pipes where it needs to be. And then you just want to check on it every so often, because at the same time, there have been malfunctions of that heat tape. There's no like concrete answer to that, but definitely the heat tape would go a long way, certainly better than trying to thaw out with a blowtorch.
Prescott?
And I would just say that, again, possibly cost prohibitive, but the professionals out there, the plumbers that are called to do this, it is their job. They do it very, very well, and it is the truly safest way to do it, is to hire the professional to take care of that for you, so you avoid. And those are the considerations you have to weigh and say there is a possibility. Especially the one recommendation we have to say is please do not try to manage this yourself with, for example, an open heating element, a blowtorch, propane heater, something along those lines. It just presents such a hazard.
I have a memory, and I don't even know if this is actually the truth of how we did it, but I have a memory from early childhood in East Middlebury of my parents keeping just a light bulb underneath the sink in the kitchen to try to make sure that the pipes didn't freeze. Is that something that you see, and is that an okay thing to do? Maybe nobody does it anymore. It was the 80s.
Even more than the light bulb, I think the main recommendation now is just keep that drip. If you know it is going to be a frigid night, and Vermont tends to have them, keep a little bit of water flowing. It really, and I truly just mean a little more than a drip, but just enough so the water is flowing through those pipes to keep it going so it doesn't freeze up on you.
Listeners, again, today we're talking about fire safety and fire risk. Gail is on the line from Elizabethtown, New York. Hi, Gail.
Yes.
Hi. Go right ahead.
Well, listen, thank you for putting this on. I've been, I had my electric upgraded to circuit breakers, but they're not arc fault. I had this done a while ago, and I wondered if this fireman has arc fault in his own home, and I've got a 200-year-old house, and I wondered what the odds are that I have some very fishy wiring in the floor somewhere.
Gail, thanks for your call. I'm not aware of what arcful wires or arcful breakers are. Do either of you know? And can you help explain to us and to Gail what might be a good call?
And Gail, I think, are you referring to the arc fault, the circuit breakers due to moisture, water, things like that, to make sure that they trip in an instance like that? Is that what you're referring to?
That's ground fault. Ground fault. Arc fault is where an old staple on your wiring kind of wears through the insulation and connects two wires. And I understand that the arc, when the electric arcs, it'll go up to 2,500 degrees or more.
Oh, and so producer Rick Singeri is popping on my screen here. An arc fault is a high-powered discharge of electricity between two or more conductors. The discharge translates into heat, which can break down the wire's insulation and possibly trigger an electrical fire. So, if that is a concern in a house, what should somebody like Gail do?
I think, again, and I don't mean to keep on putting people towards a professional, as far as, especially Vermont does have these beautiful old homes, and in these beautiful old homes, and Gail, it sounds like you, a couple hundred years old kind of thing, the wiring might be a little bit suspicious. And to that end, electrical fires are, I believe, the second highest cause of structural fires in the United States. Therefore, getting somebody to come in and just take a look at your wiring without having to tear into the entire house kind of thing would be a very smart move, especially if there is that concern of what is going to happen if you know, an arc fault, if I don't have arc fault wiring or something along those lines. Hope that answered Gail's question.
I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking about winter fire danger and getting tips on how to stay safe with Senior Williston Fire Department firefighter Prescott Natto and St. Michael's College Fire and Rescue Fire Chief Eric Haversang. John is calling in from Grand Isle. John, I understand you have some educational tips for us.
Well, it's a potential answer for the 2 a.m. fire alarm chirping.
Oh, good. Thank you.
I'm thinking that at that time is probably the coolest time in the house and putting a greatest strain on the battery, probably at its weakest point.
Ah, John, thanks. That's helpful. I actually hadn't thought of that. I really appreciate it. Thank you for calling in. And let's go to Tim, who's calling in from Barnard. Hi, Tim.
Thanks for taking the call. Hey, a suggestion to go along with the firefighting aspect and tips is that people need to have proper containers, metal containers, take their hot ashes and coals out of stoves when they're cleaning. My experience as a firefighter and what I've seen a lot of calls, and it's turned into structure fires of catastrophic event, has been that somebody will take the ashes out, might put it in a plastic bucket or a metal container, even at that rate, that it might be a proper container, set it outside on a wooden deck or right next to the house by the steps in dry grass at times of year when we don't have the snow and stuff, and it ends up causing a structure fire or even outside furthermore, like a forest fire. And maybe the other guests could speak to that, and I'm sure they've experienced that too or heard about it. But proper ash in coal buckets, and make sure you put them in a proper place outside on driveways where it's appropriate, not near houses or dry grass or wooden decks.
Yeah, Tim, thanks for the call. I really appreciate that. Prescott, what about that idea of ash and how to properly dispose of it?
I think Tim nailed it. He absolutely said as long as it's in a proper container, in a proper location that we're squared away there, something that triggered when Tim was talking about that, another thing that we need to talk about is the proper discarding of smoking material. It falls under that same category of, horrific fires have been started because of careless discarded smoking material, a cigarette, a cigar, you know, whatever it might be. And so, again, when I talk about proper disposal, it sounds basic, but, you know, an ashtray exists for a reason. And ensuring that, obviously to be clean, but also that fire hazard is very, very present. And the material that buildings are built with these days, that sort of very lightweight wood and the plastics, and also even as we're talking, some of those more old homes present a unique fire hazard that if you're talking a carelessly discarded match, a cigarette, cigar, anything like that, could cause catastrophic results.
There's a story of a guy in our town near my house who used to throw it into a hole in the tree in his yard, and the tree actually caught fire because he was throwing so many butts in there, and obviously one of them lit, and up went this 100-year-old tree. So don't do it in the tree cavern either. Let's go to Christy in Lincoln. Hi, Christy. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a number of fire extinguishers, and I don't know where to get them inspected.
Eric, is there a place to get fire extinguishers inspected?
Yeah, I know there's businesses. I know like right here in Colchester, just down the street, there's businesses that will check the fire extinguishers. So they'll check to make sure that they're within their dates, they have enough powder in them, and they're charged to the correct level. I don't know, you know, off the top of my head where in Lincoln you might be able to do that, but I think certainly doing a little research, there's definitely vendors out there that will check them, recharge them, so you don't have to go out and buy a new one if you've, you know, used it or if it's still within its good useful range.
That's not something the fire department would do.
No,
though. You know, we've been talking about a lot of the risks. One that we haven't mentioned that I think is probably less of a risk these days than it used to be, but Christmas trees. A lot of people have Christmas trees. You bring in this tree. It, as we all know, slowly drops its needles because it's, you know, getting deader and deader and drier, even if you put water in. And then you add lights to it. So are Christmas trees still a hazard, Eric?
Yeah, I would say there's still a hazard. I think to your point, it's probably less than it's been. you know, in prior years, but they're still, you know, if the tree is close to the fireplace. I mean, you can go online and look at these videos. Christmas trees burn so quick, it's very hot, the smoke's very dark. So, you know, if there's, you know, you don't discard of ashes properly, you know, the heating elements connect to the tree. If, you know, the wires spark and those, a lot of the lights you buy today, they're all LED. There's very low, you know, heat that comes off of them, but there's still certainly a risk. It's probably lower than it has been in prior years, but still there.
You know, the U.S. Fire Administration says that winter home fires account for only 8% of the total number of fires in the United States, but result in 30% of all fire deaths. Why are winter home fires more deadly?
It's actually, to be honest with you, that's a very good question.
I think we can you know, think about it. So I guess in my opinion, I would say that they're more deadly because, in my experience, they tend to happen more at night. You know, think about, I now have a 10-month-old baby. I used to get up in the middle of the night, no problem. And, you know, now she wakes up crying. It, you know, kind of takes you a second to figure out. So if you haven't practiced, you know, exiting your home, fire drills, things like that, you know, you may not have a chance. The material in the homes, you know, you've added all this extra load to the electrical system. You've brought in all your decorations, your Christmas trees. So there's more fire load in the homes, and all these added fire loads, they burn so fast, so hot, so quick that I think it certainly you have less of time to get out of your home than you did, you know, 20 years ago. And I think another thing too is, you know, winter driving is not always the best. So if it's snowy, the roads aren't all that great. It does take time for us to get where we need to go, even on a great day. And then if you add snow, you know, ice, tough access to scenes, you know, that those are all things that can hamper our abilities. If the hydrant's not shoveled out, you know, and we have to go dig for it, try to find it, those are all things that slow down our ability to put water on a fire and make sure nobody's in there.
So you're getting to some of the challenges of fighting fires in the wintertime because, you know, if the roads are icy and you're trying to get your tanker there, I mean, that is difficult, and you're trying to get it up somebody's driveway or, you know, there's ice on the roads. Prescott, what are some of the other particularly seasonal challenges of fighting fires at this time of year?
I think a big challenge that, you know, folks need to be aware of, and us as firefighters, we face nearly every you know, fire that we fight in the wintertime, is the fact that the temperature, you know, it's going to be cold out. It's going to be below freezing a lot of that time, and we fight fire with water.
Right.
Therefore, you know, something as simple as hoses freezing up, trucks freezing up, and also firefighters freezing up. We have to be concerned and considerate about our own health risks as we start to get into the time of year where temperatures drop on a regular basis. And as we just discussed, a good portion of our fires occur in the middle of the night. Fires don't occur in the best of conditions. We wish that we could predict things like that, but we can't.
So when you talk about firefighters freezing up, you know, you think of the heat of a fire, obviously, and you're putting water on the fire. How easy for it or how, you know, how close can the firefighters and the equipment actually be and still have it freeze up, because the heat is on the fire, but then a little bit away from it, you might be getting water that's freezing up right on your equipment and on your clothes.
And so that, I mean, that is exactly right. When firefighters are inside a building fighting the fire, obviously the temperatures are extremely high, and even in the building itself, it's getting heated up until we put the fire out. That's the concern, is really when the fire is extinguished and we're doing what's called overhaul, which is ensuring that the fire is completely out and not going to start up at all again. That's when the real concern is both for firefighter safety and for things freezing up, the fire hose freezing up, equipment freezing up, and like I had mentioned, trucks as well. We try to circulate our water as best as we can. We actually crack our nozzles a little bit to ensure that some water is coming out enough that they don't freeze up. But then, you know, things happen, definitely.
You know, I know the department in my town, for example, we don't have a lot of fire hydrants in rural Vermont. So you're usually getting it from a water source like a pond. What about the challenges of trying to actually get water out of a frozen pond?
It's not easy. So, we did it yesterday. We were training yesterday over in Winooski at Gilbrook Pond, and there was probably 6 inches of ice. You can break through that. It's not the fastest thing, but you can get through it with an axe. You know, once you get a little more than that, we honestly take a chainsaw and cut the ice right open. And, you know, some winters where it's real cold, you maybe have to make two cuts just to get down to water. There's other areas, and I know in Colchester, where you have dry hydrants, where it's basically just a pipe that goes out to the middle of a river or middle of a pond. You know, as long as that water hasn't frozen all the way down to the end of the pipe, you're okay, and it's a little easier. But, you know, sometimes you have to cut a hole in Lake Champlain. You have to cut a hole into ponds. It all – winter operations, it always takes a little longer than what, you know, you might think or might want.
Let's go to Chris, who's on the line with us from Tunbridge. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hey.
Hi.
I had a question about where the best place for carbon monoxide detector is, like standalone unit near the floor or a combination with a smoke detector mounted on the ceiling. I've heard kind of conflicting reports.
Chris, thanks for the call. Prescott?
So the good news is, Chris, that carbon monoxide is slightly lighter than air. So it actually will fill, and I mean very slightly, so it'll actually fill that entire area and dissipate again, you know, currents in your house, air movement, things like that. So there is no 100% correct answer. If you have it closer to the floor versus that combination smoke and carbon monoxide detector mounted to the ceiling, so long as you follow the principle of one on every level of your home, specifically one near, you know, those heating units, whether it be a hot water heater or a furnace downstairs in your basement, wherever that might be located, that would be our recommendation.
So definitely keep one in the basement if that's where all of your equipment is located.
Most definitely.
We got a note from Drew who says, we go through 5 or 6 cords of wood for our large home every year, though we have our chimney cleaned every year. Best money I spend all year. Drew says, I remember the Tot Finder stickers some time ago, and now with small kids of my own that are both in a second floor bedroom, should we have some kind of ID like this? I'm a little creeped out about peepers knowing the location of my kids' room. Also, what's the best type of escape ladder? Large house, second floor that's 15 feet off the ground. So, you know, I have seen people who, for various reasons, and when I lived in LA, it was for earthquakes. You put a note up for firefighters or for emergency responders. There are kids here or there are pets here. Should people be doing that in their Vermont homes? And then escape ladders.
Yeah. Correct? So on the sticker side, we have gone away from those Tot Finders that basically say, hey, my child's right in this room for that exact reason. So what we actually hand out now when we do fire safety PR events is it's actually a sticker that goes on the bottom right side of the door to the child's bedroom. So
inside the house.
Inside the house, yeah. So that we firefighters, if we have to go in, do a search, we can look, identify and say, okay, hey, you know, the parent has clearly called out that this is a child's bedroom. We can go in and check it. They're pretty reflective. They do the same for pets. And then in terms of the escape ladder, you can go online and identify, and I would just honestly, I would look them up, look at the reviews, make sure it's long enough to get where you want to go. But a lot of them, the way they operate is you open the window, they hook onto the windowsill, and the ladder drops down and you just kind of climb down. So I'm not aware of, you know, what's the best of those options, but they do exist. And you go to the store, go online and kind of do your own research and then pick out which one works for you.
What's the value? And I have a feeling I know your answers, but what is the value of actually practicing these things? So, for example, in one of my houses, we did have a ladder, but I never tried to take it out and see how hard it would be to actually punch out the screen and get that ladder down and get myself down. You know, my kids are little. I have never tried to train them yet. And if mom and dad say you need to go, here's how you go and here's where we go and here's where we're going to meet up. I know that you always say we should do it, but can you just really impress upon us the value of that, Prescott?
Well, I mean, I can absolutely tell you that one of the scariest things, I mean, my family, no wonder I'm a firefighter, had a few fires when I was a kid. And thank goodness nothing too terrible happened. But what I can tell you is I was really terrified. I will never forget the feeling of and sort of almost this sheer panic that came over me as a child, having my mother tell me that, get out of the house. There is a fire. There was no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And then impressing upon me that I needed to go to the neighbors and that kind of thing. Being the first time I had ever done that, it stuck with me forever. I can promise you it will never leave my mind. And that is a scary thing for anyone. I think that something as simple as one one time a year even, just actually making the effort to say, okay, it's actually decent weather. We can predict when we do a drill. It doesn't need to be below zero or winter even. But getting your family on board with that meeting spot and actually making the effort to practice it. We have to practice things every day as firefighters to become proficient, because fires don't happen every single day necessarily. We can't predict that. Same for the families, because families can't predict when fires are going to occur. The practice ahead of time so that their loved ones, their children are not truly terrified.
Yeah, it's a good thing to remember, and we all should be doing it. So thank you. This is a good reminder. I'll put it on my New Year's resolutions list. Prescott Natto is a senior firefighter on the Williston Fire Department. Eric Haversang is fire chief at St. Michael's College Fire and Rescue. Thank you very much to both of you. Really appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.